Today is Tuesday, January 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, an American man has been arrested in Russia and accused of spying. NASA makes space history with a distant flyby.
It took 9 years to launch to get to Pluto and 3 billion miles. Now another 3 years, billion miles beyond that.
North Korea's leader issues a warning to the United States. Also ahead, a record year at the box office for black films. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, an American who was visiting Moscow over the holidays to attend a wedding when he suddenly disappeared has been arrested in Russia on espionage charges. AP correspondent Lynn Barry reports.
His name is Paul Whelan, and he's a former U.S. Marine. His brother says Paul Whelan was in Moscow to attend the wedding of another former U.S. Marine and a Russian woman. He was arrested on Friday on espionage charges. Whelan's family learned about his arrest on Monday. The State Department says that it has been formally notified by the Russian Foreign Ministry and has been pushing for consular access.
Whelan's family says there's no way he's a spy.
Paul Whelan's brother says that the morning of his arrest, he had taken a group of the wedding guests on a tour of the Kremlin museums. And he had been in touch by text throughout the afternoon, but the last time anyone heard from him was at about 5 p.m. And then he failed to show up that evening for the wedding. And this was quite alarming.
The arrest comes as U.S.-Russian ties have been severely strained, in part over Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Russian gun rights activist Maria Butina is in U.S. custody after admitting she acted as a secret agent for the Kremlin in trying to infiltrate conservative U.S. political groups as Donald Trump was seeking the presidency. She pleaded guilty in December to a conspiracy charge as part of a deal with federal prosecutors. Russian President Vladimir Putin has claimed the case is fabricated and that Butina entered the guilty plea because of a threat of a long prison sentence. Here are some of the stories we're working on at voanews.com. Afghan forces have repulsed a Taliban attack on the oil fields. UK knife attacks are being treated as terrorism. Sudan's president orders an investigation amid protests. And Zimbabwe hikes fines to boost revenue. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says he's beginning the new year with hopes of more nuclear talks with President Donald Trump, but he expressed his dissatisfaction with Washington's pressure tactics. During his televised New Year's speech Tuesday, Kim said he's ready to continue direct discussions with Trump with the aim of reaching an agreement to reduce tensions and perhaps lessen a nuclear threat. I'm always ready to sit down again with the U.S. president at any time, and we'll make efforts to produce an outcome that the international community would welcome. However, if the U.S. miscalculates our people's patience, he said, forces something upon us and pursues sanctions and pressure without keeping a promise it made in front of the world, we have no option but to explore a new path in order to protect our sovereignty and achieve peace on the Korean Peninsula. Kim also said the U.S. should continue to halt its joint military exercises with ally South Korea and not deploy strategic military assets to the South. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype about Kim's speech with Evans Revere, senior advisor at the Albright Stonebridge Group, about what is going on with the North Korean officials and the He also frequently participates in official and informal dialogues with Pyongyang's reps.
It lays down a very clear marker with the Trump administration that despite all of the promises and commitments that were made or allegedly made, North Korea is now demonstrating that it has options and that it is prepared to exercise those options if the United States does not give Pyongyang what it wants. And obviously what Pyongyang wants is the easing of sanctions, and it wants the United States essentially to back off in its effort to compel North Korea to take denuclearization steps. You'll notice that the word denuclearization only appears once in the entire speech, and it's very carefully placed there right next to a reference to the June 12th declaration that was produced in Singapore. Both the United States and North Korea came out of that meeting with completely different definitions of what that word meant. And in the U.S. view, denuclearization means what the dictionary says it means, the end of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. And for North Korea, it means something very different. It means something called the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which means the elimination of the U.S. war-making capability against North Korea, both on the peninsula and near the peninsula. So you have two very different views of denuclearization. And what the North Koreans are saying is that they are tired of hearing Secretary Pompeo and other members of the administration talk about denuclearization as the U.S. defines it. So that is the unilateral demand that Kim Jong-un refers to in his speech.
So in your view, apparently, there is no change from past views of the North Korean leader. Is that correct?
I would say that that is exactly right. Yes. The North Koreans continue to define the situation on the Korean Peninsula as one in which they believe that they are under threat, nuclear and otherwise, by the United States, by the U.S.-South Korea alliance, by the presence of U.S. assets in the region. And until the United States and its allies do something about that, and until the United States takes action unilaterally as well as multilaterally to get rid of sanctions, North Korea is telling the United States that everything that was achieved or that might have been achieved as a result of the Singapore summit in June could fall apart.
Is there any possibility, or is there a possibility, of somehow reaching some kind of concession by bringing in South Korea? There seems to be a better chain of communication between North and South Korea now than there is with the United States.
Well, there certainly is a very lively and very active chain of communication between Seoul and Pyongyang. It took all of just a few minutes for the Blue House to praise Kim Jong-un's speech. South Korea seems to be keen to play intermediary, but here's the rub. In Kim Jong-un's speech, he makes reference to the need to cease joint military exercises in South Korea. He also makes reference to the need to stop importing weapons and military equipment. That demand by the North Korean leader in the speech is not directed at the United States. It's directed at South Korea. What it effectively is an open attack by the North Korean leader on the U.S.-South Korea alliance. And the message to the South Korean government that he's conveying in the speech is essentially that you, the South Korean government, now need to make a choice. Continue the process of reconciliation with us, or continue to be a part of the U.S.-South Korea alliance. It's up to you to make that choice. That's basically my summary of the message that I believe Kim Jong-un is conveying to Seoul. So Seoul is now in a very, very difficult position, having to make that choice. Because it is one of the major things that Kim Jong-un demanded of the South Koreans in that speech.
What about the change in the cabinet in the United States? Mattis is not there anymore. Kelly is not there anymore. How do you think this changes, if it does, the stance and what happens from now on as far as the U.S. is concerned?
With Mattis's departure, the United States has lost arguably one of the strongest advocates for the U.S.-South Korea alliance in the United States government, which is not to say that there aren't others, but he was one of the most ardent advocates of that alliance. And President Trump, over the last several years, including recently, has made it fairly clear that he is not a fan of alliances. He regards them as entangling. He has demanded that our alliance partners pay more for the defense that we provide them. And he has been quoted as saying some fairly derogatory and negative things about the USROK alliance, including, according to one report, asking his staff why we continue to provide for the defense of South Korea. And he asked, why can't we bring the troops home? So put that attitude, which is ascribed to President Trump, in the context of the North Korean demand of a progressive government in Seoul that South Korea take steps to begin to distance itself from the United States, and you have a fairly dangerous potential here. Beyond that, the United States and South Korea have been involved in negotiations to increase South Korea's contribution to burden sharing. In other words, the amount of funds and support that South Korea provides for the alliance. Those talks have pretty much broken down now because the United States has demanded a very significant increase in South Korean burden sharing payments and South Korea's reluctance to do that. So the scene has now been set for a very problematic period in U.S.-South Korea relations because of North Korea's demand, because of the breakdown in the burden sharing talks, and because we now have a president who has expressed interest in the past in bringing U.S. troops home. This is a pretty dangerous combination of factors.
Is there an actual possibility of moving South Korea closer to North Korea than they are to the United States?
A year or two ago, I would have said that's pretty much impossible. What has transpired in the last year is a remarkable series of conversations and exchanges and negotiations that have taken place between North and South Korea, in which there has been significant progress, some of it quite substantial, in reducing tensions, enhancing dialogue and cooperation, discussing future cooperative projects, including things like linking the railways, and other steps that the two sides have taken. So much so that it has, as I mentioned earlier, gotten some people in the United States nervous that things are moving too far and too fast between Seoul and Pyongyang. Combine that with the fact that one of North Korea's aims from the beginning has been to try to drive a wedge between the United States and its South Korean ally, and that South Korea has willingly and enthusiastically even carried some of North Korea's water in its own dialogue with the United States, encouraging the United States to take certain actions to ease up on sanctions and to introduce more conciliatory measures in its own position. So you already have the South Korean government acting in a fashion, I wouldn't say as North Korea's agent, but acting in a fashion with North Korea that one would never have imagined a year or two ago. We are in uncharted waters right now. As I said, the speech, it contains, as I said, a pretty explicit attack on the U.S.-South Korea alliance. And beyond that, the statement by the North Koreans that they might seek a new path or a new way to defend their country's sovereignty, I think, is a pretty explicit reference to their preparedness to resume nuclear and ballistic missile testing in the coming months, if things do not go their way. That ought to be of concern to us, and it's an attempt to blackmail the United States, and I use that word advisedly.
That's Evans Revere, senior advisor at Albright Stonebridge Group. NASA scientists are getting a very special New Year's Day gift. The New Horizons spacecraft has moved into unexplored space beyond Neptune to explore objects so far out in our solar system that they can hardly be seen by telescope. VOA's Jim Bertel has more.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go New Horizons!
33 minutes into the new year, NASA's New Horizons probe made space exploration history, flying by the most distant body ever explored. Scientists joined an enthusiastic crowd in celebrating the flyby of Ultima Thule at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory in the eastern state of Maryland. Mike Buckley, a spokesman for the laboratory, says the chance to photograph a mysterious space object is historic and a long time in the making.
It took 9 years after launch to get to Pluto and 3 billion miles. Now another 3 years, billion miles beyond that, we're now past Ultima Thule, outbound from the farthest object yet to be explored.
Scientists say it will take nearly 2 years for New Horizons to beam back all its observations of Ultima Thule, a full billion miles or 1.6 billion kilometers beyond Pluto. At that distance, it takes 6 hours for the radio signals to reach Earth. Over the past year, millions of children in conflict have faced life-threatening situations and have been subjected to gross human rights violations. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, is urging world leaders to do more to protect children in crisis and hold perpetrators accountable. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Violence and insecurity have forced more than 28 million children from their homes in 2018. The UN Children's Fund says it has responded to more than 300 emergencies to help children caught in many of the 40 armed conflicts raging around the world. UNICEF says children are tortured, raped, used as human shields or suicide bombers, recruited as child soldiers, and subjected to a myriad of other atrocities by armed groups. While fighting has killed and maimed tens of thousands of children, UNICEF says many more have died from the indirect consequences of conflict rather than the war itself. For instance, it notes a child dies of preventable diseases every 10 minutes in Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. President and CEO of UNICEF USA, Carol Stern, tells VOA, food insecurity has caused the rate of severe acute malnutrition to rise, with 1 in 4 children around the world being malnourished.
For example, the Central African Republic, there's been such a dramatic resurgence in the fighting there, and most of the country is part of it now. So 2 out of 3 kids are in need of humanitarian assistance in CAR right now, and 43,000 children below age 5, they're projected to face an extremely elevated risk of death due to severe acute malnutrition.
UNICEF reports escalating fighting and attacks on schools and teachers in Cameroon and in the border regions of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have deprived millions of children of an education. Similarly, it says ongoing conflict in the Lake Chad Basin is putting the education of 3.5 million children at risk. Stern says sexual violence against women and girls is being used as a weapon of war in many conflicts.
In northeast Nigeria, where you have armed groups, including the Boko Haram, they continue to target girls. This is including rape. This is forced to become wives of fighters. They're used as human bombs. I mean, really what's going on there is just horrific.
Stern says children are abused in all countries and regions of conflict, in Afghanistan, in Myanmar, in Iraq, in Syria, eastern Ukraine, and Central America. She says children are victimized by political leaders who use them as pawns to push a political agenda.
The border of our own country, the various different things that are happening around the world, Bangladesh and Myanmar, we have to separate the issue of politics from the issues that surround children.
Stern says children are not migrants. They are not refugees. They are not Somalia's children or Yemen's children or Syria's children or Rohingya children. She says they are children, first and foremost. Stern says there is nothing political about saving the life of a child. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Digital developments that have upended businesses throughout the global economy, from music to manufacturing, are also changing what the world trades and how manufacturers and merchants move and sell their goods. Experts tell VOA's Jim Randall the digital revolution presents significant opportunities, but also serious problems for countries.
Global trade is helped by digital advances like artificial intelligence, e-commerce, and machine translation. They cut costs, and that's generally helpful to exporters in smaller nations and newer, less well-financed companies, according to economists. These massive computer servers, linked together in many nations, securely track transactions and data in a digital system called blockchain. These blockchains enable new exporters in distant lands to reassure potential customers that a new company can produce goods as promised, according to World Trade Organization chief Roberto Azevedo.
Everybody knows what or who Volkswagen is, or Toyota, or IBM, but nobody knows who is a small company. Is that a legitimate business? Are they in the market for quite some time? Are they legit? Those questions blockchains would answer.
Another digital development, 3D printing, may eventually mean that some factories are replaced by devices that print physical objects instead of just words on paper. More 3D printing could cut low-skill, low-paying jobs in developing economies, according to Brookings Institution trade and technology expert Joshua Meltzer.
It would then further undermine, I think, the comparative advantages that developing countries still have in low-cost labour.
Rural areas and developing nations have the lowest level of internet access. Only about half the world's population can currently get online. Meltzer says full access to broadband and mobile devices are needed to make serious progress.
Essentially, internet plans that are affordable is going to be part of a package of measures that's just going to be needed to build the absolute foundations for any of this to matter.
Manufacturing was a key to the rise of advanced economies. But economic activity in developed nations has shifted from making things to managing ideas and information in the services economy. Advanced economies have an advantage over developing countries because they have more highly educated workers with specialized skills needed for service industries. An expert in trade and economics says the shift to a services economy could make it harder for developing nations to catch up.
So you'd already seen that start. I think the digital revolution will really advance that in to a great degree.
Claude Barfield of the American Enterprise Institute also says politics could complicate economic issues, as leaders of developing nations may be torn between allowing new digital companies the freedom they need to expand and boost economic growth and the temptation to use digital technology for social control and political purposes. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
This is International Edition.
This is Today in History. On January 2nd, 1492, the last Moorish king surrendered control of the remnant of the last Muslim stronghold of Granada in the southern Iberian Peninsula to armies of the Spanish king Ferdinand and Queen Isabella.
In 1882, American industrialist John D. Rockefeller joined the Standard Oil Company of Ohio with his other assets to form the huge Standard Oil Trust, a firm that for a time held a virtual monopoly over the U.S. oil industry. In 1905, a crucial turning point in the Russo-Japanese War occurred on this day when Japanese forces captured Port Arthur, a major Russian naval base located on Chinese territory. Russia's defeat made Japan a major regional power. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
VOA's International Edition continues now. 2018 was a year of box office successes and awards for black films. Marvel's action flick Black Panther introduced the first black superhero lead actor and grossed over $1 billion worldwide. Other films with black leading characters also did well with audiences and critics. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
Ryan Coogler's Black Panther, about a fictional African king with superhero powers and his technologically advanced country, Wakanda, has received dozens of awards and been recognized as one of the year's 10 best movies for its social and artistic significance, celebrating African and African-American cultures. Producer Nate Moore spoke to VOA about the film's power.
African-American audiences, there's a lot to pull from, and hopefully there's some inspiration again about learning about the roots of where African-Americans came from.
Black Panther is also the third highest grossing film ever in the United States and an Oscar contender. But will its success open Hollywood's doors for other black films? Too soon to tell, says media expert Richard Craig.
I think Hollywood processes that the way Hollywood processes most things, and that's looking at the bottom line, the profit margin.
But Craig believes it will be a while before high-budget film franchises such as James Bond or Spider-Man are produced with black actors as leads. He says the only black Spider-Man on film is the animated Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
We're given this cartoon version of Spider-Man to accept this black face as Spider-Man, as opposed to having a real-time, real-place actor.
However, Craig says, black movies with political or cultural messages and star actors and filmmakers attached to them have a good chance being funded by Hollywood.
Since you asked, I hate blacks.
Two such films this year are Spike Lee's Black Klansman, a dark satire based on a true story about an African-American cop infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan.
You ready for this?
And If Beale Street Could Talk, a romantic drama about social injustice and incarceration of African-American men in 1970s America by Oscar-winning filmmaker Barry Jenkins. Both films are expected to be Oscar contenders.
Let me give you a tip. You want to make some money here? Use your white voice.
My white voice?
I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife, like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer, this is Langston from Regal View.
But smaller black films by lesser-known filmmakers also showed that they can make their mark in theaters if their message speaks to the audience. Sorry to Bother You by Boots Riley advocates activism against the economic exploitation of corporate America. Not around, we go that
day. Out of the car.
George Stillman's drama, The Hate U Give, about a police shooting of an African-American teen in a black community, also went viral. Stillman said that was because the film offered an authentic depiction of African-Americans killed by police, and its message resonated with audiences all over the country.
It's about black people, poor people, everybody at the bottom.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.